Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm Zara Zimbardo, sitting in for Joseph Pache. Our topic this hour is water conservation in the Bay Area. Analysts project that by 2040, the Bay Area's population will increase by 2 million people, making our region home to almost 9 million water users. And at the same time, a changing climate will continue to exert pressure on our water supply as snowpack declines, precipitation patterns change, and sea levels rise. There is, it appears, no way around the uncomfortable reality that more people will soon have to make do with less water. So what more can and should regional authorities and consumers do to conserve water and plan for future water scarcity? And what's preventing us from taking needed steps? This hour, we'll get a read on what our water future looks like and analyze what it will take to reduce our water footprint. How far can conservation measures take us? Do we need new economic incentives to conserve? And who in our region will be most affected by future water scarcity? Joining me in studio to discuss these issues are Laura Tam, Sustainable Development Policy Director with SPUR, the San Francisco Urban Planning Think Tank. Laura coordinates SPUR's work in five major policy areas: green buildings, water supply, wastewater, energy, and climate change. She is also the author, most recently, of the report Future Proof Water, an analysis of the Bay Area's current and future water needs. Welcome, Laura.
Thank you so much.
Ethan Elkind, Climate Policy Associate with a joint appointment at UC Berkeley School of Law and UCLA School of Law. In this capacity, he serves as the lead author of UCLA-UC Berkeley's grant-funded series of policy reports on business solutions to combat climate change. Welcome, Ethan.
Thank you. Great to be here.
And Julie Ortiz, Water Conservation Manager with San Francisco Public Utilities Commission. Since joining the PUC in 2009, Julie has helped to expand the conservation program, launching a number of measures and planning studies to reduce water use and meet aggressive conservation goals. She also participates in a number of activities and committees with the Alliance for Water Efficiency, California Urban Water Conservation Council, and California Urban Water Agencies. Welcome, Julie.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And we invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation by dialing 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. Or you can email us now at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com or post a comment on KALW.org or on our Facebook page. And we'll start taking your calls in about 20 minutes. So let's begin with defining the scope and severity of the problem. Where do we get our water? Is the Bay Area's water supply in jeopardy? And if so, over what time frame? Laura, we can start with you.
Sure, I'd be glad to start. Thanks for having us and for this important discussion today. So the Bay Area is expected to, as you mentioned, add about 2 million more people within the next 25 years, and this growth will require reliable and safe water. Right now, our region depends on water imported largely from the Bay Delta and the Sierras, which snowpack provides water supply to 25 million Californians. We also have some supplies that we produce locally through groundwater and recycled water. We're dependent on imported water for about two-thirds of our water supplies. In the future, we actually have water that we need in the near term, and it's part of the major water utilities in the Bay Area to ensure that we have planned and can supply water for about the next 25 to 30 years. But as you mentioned, over the long term, by the middle of the century and beyond, that growth that's going to require water is a thirsty growth, and we will need to find some new water to meet supply or meet demands in the Bay Area, as well as to deal with diminishing supplies potentially that could be caused by climate change. So although it's not a problem in the near term, we generally have enough water to meet our current needs which is not always true during a drought, and we can get into that in the future. Mm-hmm. Since we're having such a dry year, we really need to begin planning now for future supplies and to meet the needs of people in the future.
But there is actually potentially a more immediate need to conserve water. I think it's an excellent point that, you know, in the near term we're in good shape in terms of water supplies. But there is this connection between water use and energy use, and that was the main focus of our work and our report at Berkeley and UCLA, which is that every time you turn on the tap, when water's coming out, there's energy in there. There's energy embedded in that water. And as we think about climate change, it's easy on the, when you're thinking from the perspective of water, you're thinking about diminishing snowpack and more droughts and that sort of thing. But we also have a responsibility to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. And as we use water, it requires electricity to pump that water, natural gas in certain cases, to heat it, to treat it once we dispose of it. If it's urban water use in particular, which is the case here in the San Francisco Bay Area, excluding the agricultural areas, then it's the most energy-intensive water because it has to be pumped, has to be treated, and it has to be treated on disposal as well. So conserving water has an immediate benefit of conserving energy, which I think not a lot of people understand that connection, and that's something that we're trying to raise awareness about.
And I'd say also on the practical and immediate front for the consumer, it means that everyone really needs to do what they can, whether it's in their home, in their business, in the school, or the place they spend the most time, to use water wisely. And we all play a role in helping to conserve our water for future generations.
Thank you. And I'd love to return to this issue of conservation in more depth and at different scales in terms of what the consumer can do, government agencies, industry, policy planning. So in terms of near future and longer term severity of access to water in the San Francisco Bay Area, do you think that we could experience a severe or extreme drought? And how do you define drought? And how have we dealt with drought in the past?
Well, I'll take that one. We, you know, drought is something that Bay Area water agencies, of which there are, I think, about 9 or 10 major ones, there's a way to plan for drought. We have had droughts in the past. For example, 1977 was a pretty severe drought for the Bay Area, and many water agencies look at that year and other dry periods as a way of determining how much water they may not have in a future drought, and they plan around having a certain percentage of a certain amount of a shortage, and they figure out ways to make up that shortage. Sometimes it's asking people to conserve water. Sometimes it's importing water from other areas that may have more water, other parts of the state. But there's a percentage that agencies manage to in order to figure out how much they need to make up during a drought. Mm-hmm. And it's an amount that is set, you know, by agency. It's kind of a political decision. It's important to recognize that, you know, some parts of the Bay Area in a dry year are going to be better off than others. It kind of depends on where they get their supplies from, how much conservation they can ask people to do, how much, and the sort of variability in where the rain is falling. So it's kind of a mix, but it's not an unexpected thing. Drought occurs. We plan for it. We know it can happen. It could be happening now. And a lot of the state and our regional economy is based on having a firm water supply. So it's a very important thing for agencies to track, and they do a very good job of it.
Mm-hmm. And with regards to this, are all parts of the Bay Area equally vulnerable, or are some counties more water secure than others?
I would say from our research, we found that some parts of the region are better off than others in a dry year. They have better water rights. They have more secure. They have drought plans that are prepared for a smaller drought than others. So they vary in terms of where they can get more water, where they've secured other places to transfer water to them, and in how well they'll do in an event of being dependent on one or more sources. some water agencies have four or five major supplies that they can, they have a sort of diversified portfolio, mm-hmm. and others don't have quite as many. So if one of those supplies is diminished, it may be harder for them to make up the gap.
Mm-hmm. And I think another thing is that different water districts have different cultures of conservation, and a lot of that gets back to their rate structure, which I think mm-hmm. is a really important piece of the puzzle in terms of making sure that people conserve as much water and are as efficient as much water as they can be. And so certain water districts, for example, have what's called a budget-based or allocation-based water rate structure where they'll take a look at the size of your property and the types of building you have on it and give you a certain allocation. And then as you go over that allocation, you pay a higher amount in water rates. Mm-hmm. Or there are other things like inclining block rates where basically you're in certain tiers where you can conserve at a lower rate for a certain amount. But then as you go over that, it becomes marginally more expensive to use water. And that kind of thing is really critical at really promoting water conservation and really encouraging people to be as efficient as possible. And certain water districts have been better about doing that than others. And I think those that have been better at that are going to be better prepared for the droughts, which are inevitable.
Mm-hmm. I would also just add that some of them are doing more work than others to look at potential future scenarios of climate change. So I know, for example, that the San Francisco PUC and East Bay Mud here within the Bay Area have done a lot of modeling to look at how their Sierra reservoirs are going to do in the face of potential future warmer temperatures and changes in precipitation. So that's another area of preparation that it's not completely even across the Bay Area.
Mm-hmm. One underlying element of our conservation program, too, is to look at long-term conservation changes. So while we do prepare for drought-related effects and increasing messaging and outreach during drought periods, our conservation program and that a number of the other utilities run now, too, really looks at long-term infrastructure changes people can make. So those water reductions aren't going to go away when the drought ends.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Julie. And in terms of, well, we are emerging from a very dry winter, and the most recent news shows that the snowpack is at 50% now. When we're looking at causes in terms of what are some of the biggest threats to our water supply, you've touched on some of them, but how would you weigh that in terms of population growth, climate change resulting in less rainfall or predictability in terms of the Sierra snowpack, increasing demands from the agricultural sector, and also a number of you have spoken about infrastructure in terms of aging or inadequate infrastructure, as well as earthquakes or other natural disasters. What are some of the threats that loom largest in terms of talking about near and more distant future?
Well, I think we're kind of facing a big squeeze coming up. We have a growing population. California is projected in the next few decades to get to 50 million people. We're at about 36 million now. So we've got a lot more people coming in. And with climate change and the likely forecasted impacts, some of which we're already experiencing right now in the state, it's going to really hurt our water supply, and it'll hurt it in some specific ways. So first of all, the climate scientists project that we'll see a dwindling snowpack, and that less of the precipitation in the mountains in the Sierra, which are essentially our big refrigerator that holds on to the water that then melts and gives us water year-round in California, precipitation will come down as rain. It won't be stored as snow. It means we'll have a lot of potential flooding issues. In addition, we're looking at rising sea levels. We've already seen an 8-inch sea level rise in the Golden Gate Bridge just in this past century. And as that salt water rises, it's going to be inundating some of our groundwater supplies and creating the salination problem in our freshwater. And then, of course, we've got the San Joaquin Sacramento Delta, which is really the linchpin of our entire water infrastructure. So for Southern California, they get their water through the State Water Project, a lot of their water through the State Water Project, and that gets funneled through the Delta, which is right now seismically vulnerable. So in the event of a big earthquake, those levees where a lot of that water and a lot of that land is below sea level, the levees break and could contaminate the water and essentially break the water conveyance system in the state. So that could, you know, that could happen anytime. But and I think underscores the need for some sort of action to solve that infrastructure challenge. But beyond that, I think we can safely predict that we're going to be looking at unpredictable water supplies and a growing population. And so it's going to be a real challenge for the state and something that we need to get ahead of right away.
Thank you, Ethan. Laura or Julie?
I would just add that, you know, we mentioned earlier that about 2 million people will be coming to the Bay Area within the next 25 years. That's only a quarter of the growth that's coming to California, as Ethan just touched on, within that time. We have the same amount or possibly even less water supply in the future that has to be funneled through this, the Delta and other plumbing systems that are all throughout California. And it's going to be increasingly harder to compete for the limited water that we have in California. And so as a result, in our new report, Future Proof Water, we recommend that agencies prioritize demand management measures, which of course includes conservation and efficiency, as the first best way to save water before turning to developing new supplies. But we also recommend to the point that you mentioned about earthquake resilience, it's not just the Delta that is, although the Delta is probably one of the most seismically vulnerable areas of the state. And if that system fails and saltwater enters the distribution systems for the State Water Project and the Central Valley Project, I recently learned that could interrupt water supply to Southern California for a year and a half, which is extraordinarily significant. But we also have major aqueducts that cross the state and cross major fault lines to bring water to the Bay Area that are not conveyed through the Delta. So another of our recommendations was for water agencies here to evaluate their water supply and delivery systems, which include all the pipes that bring us water within our cities and around the region, not just bringing it to the region, but conveying it around, to evaluate the vulnerability of all of these areas and systems to seismic, to earthquakes, and to develop risk reduction plans and invest in reliability upgrades to meet level of service goals. And this is something that a lot of water utilities in the region are taking very seriously, including the San Francisco PUC.
Yeah, for example, as part of the rebuild of our regional water system, a $4.6 billion seismic retrofit, our agency did make a significant policy decision to reduce the amount of water that we'll import from the Sierra Nevadas in response to protecting ourselves from climate change and drought and just general unreliability. So that 10 million gallons a day by 2018 goal is to be made up through aggressive conservation, more recycled water, groundwater, and alternative water use.
And another point on the growing population and the fact that we're going to be having to accommodate a lot of new residents here in California, and I know this is something that Laura and Spur have worked on a lot, is it's also a question of how we grow. So, for example, if we're going to be continuing with development as usual practices where we have the sort of suburban sprawl, and particularly in areas like the Central Valley, which is projected to be the fastest growing region of the state over the coming decades, if we grow in a more urban kind of way, it's been shown over and over again that people who live in a more compact environment tend to use less water. They don't have the big lawns. They might have a smaller home that would require less water infrastructure. So that's another potential wild card in terms of how successful we are at accommodating growth and meeting them with our water supplies.
The San Francisco Bay Area was recently listed as one of the top 10 cities in the United States that will most certainly, as you've been talking about, be facing extreme water scarcity in the future. What does severe water scarcity mean in practical terms for the consumer? And if you could maybe speak a bit about what might be, best or worst case scenarios, thinking as far ahead as 2050.
Well, in San Francisco, we do a lot of long-range forecast planning as well as assessment of our conservation potential. And through our estimates, it does show us in a relatively good position while we forecast some shortfall by 2035. It may not be quite as significant as some of the other areas that Laura notes in her studies, but it definitely points to the need to continue a very aggressive conservation program that is reaching out to all our customer sectors, single-family homes, multifamily homes, the non-residential sector, and doing everything we can, because the way we'll be able to meet our demand projections is by holding the per capita water use down and through those conservation activities.
But I think we've gotten a taste in California of what, I mean, we certainly know, most of us who've been here for a few decades know what drought is like. I mean, having grown up here in the Bay Area, and I remember in the 80s in particular, repeated years of drought, I think we all, those of us who were there, know what that is like, which is that you pay a lot of money for water, and you're under a lot of pressure to really monitor your personal water usage. So things like not flushing the toilet, taking very brief showers. I think that for people who grew up here, I think during that time period, we're kind of aware of that. And I think, you know, it's pretty safe to say that would probably be what life would be like under an extreme drought, and perhaps to a worse degree than that. But again, I think depending on how we do our rate structures, that can also help us prepare for that so that we're not wasting a lot of water in a sort of automatic way through our appliances and our water infrastructure, and we get people sort of conditioned and hopefully not seeing a huge negative in their lifestyle, that we're not really asking people to sacrifice but to really change and be more aware and more efficient.
Yeah, I would certainly add that there are a lot of policy tools for and technological tools and economic tools for asking people to conserve water. And Californians are familiar with how to do it. Bay Area agencies have found that just by asking people to conserve water and making them aware that there's a drought, they can save 10% to 15% of water, which is often enough to get you through a dry year or a couple dry years. Beyond that, you know, agencies can put together measures to bring in new supplies, or you know, there are a host of ways that you can get to reducing overall demand without going to rationing, which is what happens in a very, very severe drought that goes on for a very long time, and nobody really likes to do that. So there's a lot of things that we could talk about, policy tools that could be put into place, including the rate structures that Ethan is mentioning, to help incentivize conservation and to sustain it beyond the ask that happens during a drought.
Thank you. And we're going to go more in depth into conservation strategies and policies in a moment. If you're just tuning in now, this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at kalw.org. Tonight, we're discussing water conservation with our guests Laura Tam, Sustainable Development Policy Director with SPUR, Ethan Elkind, Climate Policy Associate at UC Berkeley School of Law and UCLA School of Law, and Julie Ortiz, Water Conservation Manager of San Francisco Public Utilities Commission. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments by dialing 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134, or you can email us now at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com or post a comment on our website. Are you a conscious water conserver? What do you think the Bay Area should do to encourage conservation? And we'll go to our first couple callers. On line one, we have, hello, Austin, calling from San Carlos. What question would you like to pose to our guests?
Hi, I'm a teacher in Redwood City, and I know that reclaimed or recycled water has met with a lot of public opposition or resistance. And I was wondering, are there efforts to try to reach out to maybe school-age children to try to change that? And, you know, what can I do as an educator to get the biggest bang for the buck with the limited time we have to help with encouraging youth to recycle and conserve water?
Well, we love to teach kids about water recycling and water conservation. The San Francisco Public Utilities Commission, as well as a number of other utilities, offer curriculum and materials to teachers. We have sections on water conservation, sections on water recycling, and all the other water supply programs. If you're interested, if you go to our website at sfwater.org, you can even download that curriculum that includes a number of different lesson plans and very specific activities that you can incorporate in relatively little time into the classroom. But we do a lot of outreach. That's just one example. We have a number of classroom on-site field trips and demonstration gardens and other types of sites that we like to bring kids to so they can see the water efficiency at work.
And one thing, this is a great question about recycling water, and there is that kind of ick factor that it seems hard for people to get over, even though it's not it's not really rational. I mean, the water is as clean as anything that we drink now. But one way that I think that policy could help encourage people to be more open-minded to it is that you can have a rate structure, again, going back to this rate structure issue, that where you give people lower rates if they're willing to sign up for recycled water. So that's, you know, you give people the option that people don't like to be forced to have to, you know, drink something that they find psychologically distasteful, even though, again, there's no reason for that in terms of the purity of the water. But if you can incentivize them through a different rate structure, give them the option, that might be a way we can encourage it. And it's something that we definitely need to do more of, is recycle the water that we do have.
Hmm. Yeah, I would just encourage, I mean, from a science teaching perspective or teaching children about water and conservation, the importance of that. I mean, one thing besides teaching about conservation, it's important to get a whole new generation of kids aware of resources and where they come from and where they go and how important it is to steward those resources. But on the water and recycled water question, I believe you could teach them that there really is no such thing as completely new fresh water. The world's water is a recycled water system. And we have the ability today to sort of purify any sort of water and make it drinkable. And the idea that we would be purifying wastewater and drinking it is not new at all. It's done all over the world. It's done all over America. And in fact, the 25 million Californians who drink water from the Delta are doing it already. So it just mixed in with a bunch of other sources by that time. So once you tell people what it goes through to become purified and that the water cycle is something that's part of how we get water, I think that U factor becomes less and less an issue, and teaching kids this is a sure way to make sure that the next generation of adults continues to be highly mindful of conservation and the value of water.
Thank you, Laura. And let's go to line two with Andrew calling from Athens.
Yes,
welcome, Andrew.
Hello?
Yes, welcome to City Visions. What would you like to add to the conversation or ask the guests?
Yes, ma'am. I would just like to, one, say that Ethan has hit the nail on the head several times, and I think the other guest speakers agree with him that rate structures and charging water for the precious resource that it is critical, because without it, we would perish in pretty short order. But in particular, one device, and I'm sure there's some already in the Bay Area, but it's probably not 100% easy to say, that waterless urinals and other water-saving devices like that, each waterless urinal in a commercial restroom, men's room, of course, is said to save about 40,000 gallons of water per year, and that is a staggering amount just for one fixture. If you can consider that across how many are in the city of Oakland and San Francisco, having structures also rates or whatnot to encourage that, and or perhaps even mandate it at some point if some folks don't want to play ball and realize that we can't continue to pee into fresh water. That's just, and for that matter, poo into it as well, is a quite really retarded if you think about it.
Well, so I agree. I mean, we want to see these sort of investments in water-saving technologies, and I think you're definitely right that having a water rate structure that encourages that will help make it pencil out for a business. For, you know, as you mentioned, a business investing in waterless urinals, they're going to do the numbers. Is it worth spending the money for this? And if the water rate structure will help determine that, if the costs are great, if they just keep it the urinals as is. And this could be, it's not just urinals. It's, you know, all sorts of water-using appliances and devices and infrastructure. And then the other piece of that is the financing. So it costs money to buy these technologies, and some of them are not that expensive, but some of them are. And so the other piece of it is, how do you convince a business to invest in it? Now, maybe these things will pay for themselves over 7 years, over 10 years, but, you know, if you're a business, and I'm thinking, you know, the commercial side, and it's somewhat true for residential as well, you're thinking, well, how else could I invest that money? And I might get a rate of return that's going to pay me back that investment and more a lot sooner. And so some of it is that I think on the public sector side, we need mechanisms that help make it easy to get access to financing that's dedicated specifically for these sort of efficiency upgrades. That's definitely true on the energy side, and it's true on the water side as well. So, you know, helping businesses find access to capital, and that they'll repay because because they'll repay it from the savings, but they don't want to dedicate that money up front, or they don't have that money up front. And it's true for residential users as well. I mean, many of us, there's all sorts of things we could be buying that will pay for themselves through saved water bills and saved electricity bills, you know, tankless water heater, or more efficient furnace, all sorts of things that are going to pay back. But we don't have the few grand up front, or if we have it, we need to save it for something else or spend it on something else. Mm-hmm. Or just psychologically, it's kind of hard to get past that big upfront cost, even if you know, hey, by 2015, I'm going to get that money back. So I think on the public sector side, we can help provide capital for people to make that investment.
And in San Francisco, there is a green finance program that helps commercial buildings do just that. They can finance energy efficiency and water conservation projects up front. Also, our agency offers rebates for toilets, urinals, all sorts of different water-efficient fixtures. Now, why that does require a little bit of upfront expenditures, we working with everything from large facilities, big hotels, down to single-family homes, find that it's a very short payback period. It can be 2 years or less, and then you really do see significant water savings and cost savings as well. Mm-hmm. So would definitely encourage anyone who's thinking about upgrading their fixtures and putting in more efficient ones to make sure they've looked at all opportunities for rebates and incentives.
Thank you, Julie.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Other Bay Area utilities also offer rebates for a lot of water efficient fixtures. And in a separate report that we did at SPUR a few years ago, we looked at the potential for multifamily apartment buildings to invest in water efficient fixtures and found a very, very short payback period for significant overhauls in plumbing and fixtures, low flow toilets and high efficiency shower heads. Many buildings found that it paid off. It found a 15 to 30% water savings and like a 40 to 50% cost savings, and the price of water isn't going down. So making those investments now could actually save money in the very near term. It's a really good investment most of the time.
And some of these investments, it's not just those water savings, but you also get the electricity bill savings as well. So if you think about things like a dishwasher, it's using both water and electricity, or water heater using gas and water. So if you invest in one type of appliance, you sometimes get a sort of a double savings on both bills.
Thank you. And we have a couple other callers waiting on the line. Jamie is calling from San Francisco. Welcome to City Visions, Jamie.
Oh, hi. Thank you very much. I've taken advantage of the low-flow toilet program, the rebate, and I appreciate that. And the conversation seems to be primarily around what individuals can do to conserve, which is obviously very good. But I just wanted, if it's not off-topic, I wanted to ask about a couple other things that might affect the state's water. And one of those is farming and kind of what the PUC might be doing to work with farmers to reduce evaporation and runoff. That's one question. And then I'd like to also ask about rain catchment and if there's any plans for infrastructure to treat that, to make that potable water. And if it's not too piggish of me, I guess, could I also ask, is the aquifer in Golden Gate Park potable water for an emergency at the west end by the windmills? Does anybody know from the PUC? Thank you for all of those, the farming and the rainwater catchment and treatment.
Thank you. Julie, did you want to start off responding to this question?
Well, I can take some of them. As far as farming goes, within San Francisco, we do actually have some ordinances and movement to encourage urban farming and community gardens, and some assistance available through the PUC for folks interested in that. We have a grant program where people can apply for an irrigation meter if they have a site that's a community garden or developing urban ag. And I'll maybe let another speaker talk about ag lands outside the city. In terms of rain catchment, rain harvesting systems, we also provide assistance with that. We've been able to help a number of schools in San Francisco install cisterns and rain gardens. And we have a lot of information available on our website as well, some how-to manuals and technical guidance. So I would encourage the caller to definitely take a look at sfwater.org, search for rainwater harvesting. In terms of the aquifer, I think the question is in reference to the groundwater basin under the west side of the city. Mm-hmm. And we are working on a program now to actually blend some of the water from wells that will tap into that aquifer to blend it into our potable drinking water supply. So all of that would meet the highest water quality standards and be monitored regularly.
And on the agriculture question, it's a little bit beyond the scope of what we covered in our report, Drops of Energy, at the law schools at UCLA and UC Berkeley. But if you look at the agriculture sector in California, it does use about 80% of the state's total water. So urban water use is just the other 20%. So it is the big water user in the state is the agriculture sector. Of course, it's one of our most productive economic sectors in the state as well. And from an energy perspective, it's not as energy intensive because you don't need to treat the water to the same standard since it's not for drinking. And also since most agriculture happens in the Central Valley, you have gravity to provide water for a lot of those farms. But having said that, you know, the old expression is that whiskey is for drinking and water's for fighting over. So the water rights in California are complex. It's a really difficult, complex area of the law, but they go back centuries in some cases. And it's a hard thing for policymakers to sort of have any sort of influence over how water is used. But having said that, also, you know, farmers have their own incentives to conserve in certain situations, and they're investing in different types of irrigation technologies, drip irrigation, and different sort of efficiency measures in that way. But it is something that we want to see all sides of water users, all sectors do their part to conserve. But the water rights situation, and especially for agriculture, is a complex thing. And I think, you know, there are some efficiency measures being implemented, but, you know, there are more things that policymakers potentially could do to encourage efficiency in that sector. I think that's not an overstatement.
And let's just take a brief break. This is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. Tonight, we're discussing water conservation with our guests, Laura Tam, Sustainable Development Policy Director with SPUR, Ethan Elkind, Climate Policy Associate at UC Berkeley School of Law and UCLA School of Law, and Julie Ortiz, Water Conservation Manager with San Francisco Public Utilities Commission. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments. Do you regularly conserve water? Do you worry about future scarcity? If not, why not? The number to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And we have another call of from Rosemary calling from Berkeley. Welcome, Rosemary.
Thank you. My biggest concern is the amount of water that fracking is going to use. If it's allowed in our state, and apparently they're selling the property that will allow that, and that will poison our water. And I want to know if the various agencies that are concerned with our water supply are putting any pressure on the governor or powers that be to try to halt this fracking that will make what we're talking about tonight seem almost foolish.
Thank you, Rosemary.
So you've brought up a really important issue, hydraulic fracturing, which is it's been going on for decades, but it's some technological advances that have really kind of spurred it on in the last few years, and it's a method to extract oil and natural gas. And potentially in California, we're sitting on some very large deposits of oil and gas that, you know, some people think could lead to sort of a mini economic boom in certain parts of the state that I think could benefit the state's economy. But there are some, as you refer, some serious environmental concerns, particularly related to groundwater. So in terms of, you know, to answer your question, I don't know what the what folks in the state water agencies and the regional water districts are saying in response to this state push to kind of let fracking happen to some extent. But there is a regulatory process that has just begun to regulate hydraulic fracturing or fracking. And the Department of Conservation, the State Department of Conservation, is in charge of that process. So if this is an issue that you're interested in, I would get involved. The public is able to speak on this issue at different hearings. We can take comments, written comments. So get involved, and that's what would be my advice in that regulatory process that's just unfolding now, because we don't have regulations right now for fracking, and we have some environmental laws that govern this sort of thing but have not really been applied. I'm thinking of the California Environmental Quality Act, for example, which requires environmental review and analysis of big decisions like fracking. But this regulatory framework should hopefully address this, and I think we need the public to be involved and engaged on this issue, because it is a serious concern, and there's a lot of economic activity at stake as well. So,
thank you. And let's go to Chad, who's calling from San Francisco. Welcome to City Visions.
Yes, thank you. I am interested in the idea of municipal gray water systems, wherein potentially water that's treated can return to users, not as drinking water, but, say, water for other uses, such as landscaping or washing your clothes, et cetera. And if that's even really an efficient use of resources for developed urban areas, if it's an efficient use of resources for these new areas of growth, I'm thinking the Central Valley. And something that's related, it seems that I heard something in a class at San Francisco State that San Francisco had tried out a gray water treatment plant some time ago. And I was wondering if I had that right, or if that was just a small-scale experiment, or if anyone knows anything about that. So that's my question.
Great. Thank you, Chad.
Well, I'll start first by talking about what we're doing here in San Francisco. And we are definitely looking at on-site reuse of non-potable water, gray water, black water, water from foundation drainage, rainwater. In terms of gray water, we started first really looking at what might we be able to do at a residential level. And the first type programs that we really explored included residential level, what we call laundry to landscape. It's a gray water incentive program that basically you can take the water from your laundry machine and use it to help irrigate your garden, subsurface outdoor irrigation. And we also provided a permit, some assistance for same type of residential level gray water projects that would use it for outdoor irrigation. We still have that program open. And in fact, if anybody out there is interested, they can certainly call us at 551-4730 and learn more. If you have a flat or downsloping backyard and a laundry machine and some garden space that you're looking to irrigate, that's really all you need within the city. And you can contact us to learn more. And then after looking at that residential level, we have since really expanded our focus and have been looking more broadly at larger mixed use and commercial type facilities. And the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission has worked very closely with the local health department and the Department of Building Inspection to develop an ordinance in the city that would help establish a framework for how builders of new buildings or large projects could look at reusing the gray water, the black water, the other water sources. And this also helped establish a permitting process and guidelines that before weren't as clear in the state how to proceed. And our agency, we do provide technical and financial assistance. So if there are any builders out there who are interested in this, you can receive assistance from us if you can offset all of the water, the potable water you would have used for toilet flushing with non-potable water, or if you can reduce the water use by 40%. And the PUC's new headquarters at 525 Golden Gate Avenue in San Francisco is a great example. We're doing that on site, and so we completely reuse all of our water. All of the water used for toilet flushing is non-potable. Mm-hmm. We also catch the rainwater and help use that to irrigate the landscaping outside. The lobby to our building is public and open. We have a beautiful mural down on the first floor, so if anybody's interested, encourage them to come by, take a look at it, and we can also set up a tour as well.
And Julie, could you see that phone number that you mentioned one
more
time?
Yeah, absolutely. 415-551-4730. And you can also visit our website at www.sfwater.org/conservation.
And we have Margaret calling from San Francisco. Welcome, Margaret, to City Visions.
Oh, thank you. I'm just thrilled to be listening. I'm taking all kinds of notes, and I want to come down to Golden Gate tomorrow and see what's going on. I recall the drought in the we lived in Fresno during 89 through 91, and how we had a brick in our toilet, and all the lawns went brown, and what I'd like to stress is that, you know, that just the teamwork and community action, teachers, pastors, ministers, officials getting together and having seminars and getting the word out, or young groups of people, young students. I have a daughter-in-law to be who's studying for her engineering degree, and she wants her. This is what she wants to do, is to see pure water in the future for all of us. And I'd also like to say that, for me, a bottom line is just gratitude. I always start with feeling grateful for what we have and what we have in San Francisco. And I would also like to mention that I'm a little squeamish when you hear about these systems where they recycle the water with the sewage and everything. And are any of you familiar with Dominique Laporte, the French author?
No.
Margaret, was there a particular, you've made some valuable comments, was there a particular question you wanted to pose to the guests?
Well, I want to refer this book. You might have, it's from the MIT, you know, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and it's called The History of Shit. And
okay,
There's one point. Sorry to interrupt.
Uh-huh,
she said something I thought was interesting, which is the attitude of gratitude for what she has, and I think it's an interesting concept. But I think it also points maybe at a more practical level to awareness of the resources that we're using, and I think that is a big start for a lot of people. And they run the tap, they don't really think about the resource there and the value of that resource and the preciousness of that resource. And I think about on the energy side, when auditors come in, and I think of energy auditors, not auditors like, even though it's tax season, that's a different kind of auditor. But when they come in to look at how a building performs and how someone who works in that building uses energy, a lot of what they do, they say you can install this kind of energy efficiency light switch or this kind of technology, but a lot of it is behavioral. And really encouraging people just be aware of the resources that we're using. So again, it's not a matter of sacrifice or guilt or anything like that, but just an awareness that I think will lead to a natural sort of efficiency that really doesn't intrude on our quality of life. And in some ways, and I think this caller pointed to it, it can actually enhance your quality of life because you're more appreciative of the resources that you have.
Yeah, I like to piggyback on that too. Not only is it important to be aware, but it's reusing water is one of the more sustainable new supplies that we can have to help meet our growing demands. After we try to conserve and reduce the need for every last drop through conservation programs and through efficient technologies, the next best thing we can do, reduce, reuse, recycle, is to do reuse of the water that we already import. We bring water so far across California to flush toilets in San Francisco, and we could be doing more throughout the Bay Area to recycle water and to match appropriate water to appropriate uses. We don't drink recycled water right now. We only use it for landscape irrigation. We can use it for toilet flushing. We can use it for laundry. Of course, it is our hope, and we recommend in our report that in the future we treat that recycled water to a potable standard so we could possibly be able to drink it here in the future, which would not only be a better way of making the resources that we import go further and be more sustainable, but it is much more sustainable and energy efficient than taking ocean water and trying to treat that to a potable standard. So reuse mm-hmm. and recycling is really kind of the next wave after conservation, I think, to maximize the use of the resources that we have and to further the sustainability of our region.
Thank you. There's a couple callers who are waiting, but I'd like to read this email that just came in with a question for our guests. to ask if you would please talk about the manufactured demand for bottled water. Is there any reason to buy bottled water and contribute to Nestle and to Coke's bottom line, harmful groundwater mining, and the degradation of the world's environment? Why didn't the bill in 2010 pass that would have required water bottlers to report how many millions of gallons they take from California's public aquifers? And why have Californians been spending 2,000 times more for a bottle when we have clean, safe, and great-tasting stuff from the tap? Julie?
Well, those are all great comments and questions. In San Francisco, we certainly encourage people to drink tap water. We have very high-quality tap water. Our agency's also been involved in installing drinking water stations in the city and in schools to help encourage kids to refill their bottles. And so you can find some of those bottle refill stations. But I can't answer the question as to why bottled water industry, other than money, hasn't made some changes, but certainly at our level. As part of our education, our outreach to kids in school curriculums, we certainly highlight the importance of using tap water and taking advantage of the great high-quality water we have here locally.
Mm-hmm. A number of restaurants as well have begun to have tap pride.
Right. That's actually, in one of our rules and regulations to serve tap water, drinking water restaurants.
Yeah, I think the caller answer, or the writer answered some of their own questions with that one. But certainly our drinking water is subject to quality regulations that are really stringent and also don't apply to bottled water. So you can be sure that your tap water is pretty safe to drink, and water agencies are required to report on the quality of that water to their customers every year. And tap water is not so similarly regulated at all, if at all. So
bottled water, right.
Tap water is safer to drink.
Right, but the marketing can often tell us the opposite.
Right, unfortunately.
And we have Kelly, who's calling in from Berkeley. Kelly, welcome to City Visions.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I appreciated where the conversation was headed a moment ago, talking about awareness of our resources and where they're coming from. I know for me, my sort of environmental and the footprint awareness definitely came about from living in different regions in my suburban upbringing, like studying abroad in West Africa, where, you know, you had to carry your water for 3 to 5 miles, and whether that was for drinking or showering or bathing. Or in interior Alaska, where I lived in a dry cabin, and you had to haul water very far from town, and you had to make it stretch. And you became very aware as those resources, you saw them, you had to carry them, you had to haul them. And then you start to realize how much you're really using and how little you can really get by on. And I love all the new technological advances in terms of, I love this, reusing, re-cleaning wastewater. That's an amazing idea, and that we can do it. Yeah, it sounds icky, but we need to grow into that idea. And economic incentives as well to help us change our water usage. However, I wonder if not the root of it is at a cultural level and at a thought level in terms of how do we think of water? How do we think of resources in terms of this is a global commons resource, not just a Bay Area problem. And if we see our water as something that we all share and that no one has, we all have a duty to one another and to, I would say, global creation, to use it as intelligently and critically as possible. And that's a duty that we, you know, share with every other human being on the planet, and that no one owns it, and that we're all
certainly
sort of from a great commons.
Thank you, Kelly. I think there's quite a lot of agreement in the room. Thank you for contributing those thoughts to this important conversation. It's wonderful how many calls are coming in, and we're going to go to Vince, who is calling from San Carlos. Hello, Vince. Are you there?
I am.
Welcome to City Visions.
Thanks for doing great programming like this. I think it's the more people learn about this stuff, the better we're all going to be.
But I live in San Carlos, and I have, fortunately, a storm drain that goes through our property, you know, a catch basin, and it also is an area for the hillside to drain groundwater through. And I talked to the county, and what we did is we hooked up an irrigation pump to irrigate the property, which they love the idea because it's reusing that water that would basically go to waste. And like you said earlier, we're not wasting precious, you know, drinking water to irrigate, you know, a big piece of land. And is that something that other homeowners can do? You know, is it something that, you know, your programs look into?
Is this a question for Julie?
Mm-hmm. Well, across San Francisco, we certainly are looking at a lot of projects to help infiltrate stormwater into the groundwater basin. And I mean, it just helps with plants and growth and keeps it out of our wastewater system so we don't have to spend that money to treat it otherwise and discharge it. So there are a number of projects to add bioswales and rain gardens and other green infrastructure areas that will help do just that, take the stormwater runoff and use it productively to help with the plant growth and prevent it from having to be treated through the wastewater treatment system.
And we're just about coming to the end of our time, so thank you so much to everyone who has called in. And Laura, Ethan, Julie, just wanted to ask if you would like to have any final words that you'd like to leave our listeners with in terms of some top things to be aware of, in terms of some of the most pressing issues or ways to plug in to learn more to start incorporating some of these changes with greater awareness and mindfulness, as you were saying. Laura?
Well, I would just add that, you know, everyone can do their part by making their own homes as water efficient as possible, saving water, teaching your kids to save water, and showing public support in the political arena when a water agency needs to invest in a program or adopt a new rate structure or to make it possible for more people to participate in this important project of water efficiency and conservation in the region. You know, we're not getting more water from the Sierras. We might even have less, and there are going to be more people here in the future. We've been very effective over the last 20 years, 25 years in this area, probably due to our heightened consciousness and concern around the issue. We've been very effective at keeping water use relatively flat in spite of the growth that we've had. So let's try to sustain that going forward. It will be better for everyone.
Great. Thank you.
And I would underscore that there's political support for the changes that we need in the state, whether it's water rate structures or financing programs, and also encourage people to look into the different financing programs that are available to pay for some of this infrastructure. For example, there's a property assessed clean energy program, or PACE, which is available for commercial customers and residential customers in some areas, although the federal government has issued some rulings that have undercut it temporarily. But that's a great financing program. There's on-bill financing where you can get essentially a loan from your water utility and then pay it back on your bill. So different programs like that to help pay for this transition, which we need.
And if you're a customer or a water user in the SFPUC service area, then by all means, call us. We offer a number of free services. We'll come out and do a free on-site home or business water-wise evaluation, help you learn more about your water use. And we have a number of other incentives. So, again, you can reach us at 415-551-4730, and we can also direct you to other utilities.
Thank you so much. That's City Visions for this evening. Our guests tonight were Laura Tam, Sustainable Development Policy Director with SPUR, Ethan Elkind, Climate Policy Associate at UC Berkeley School of Law and UCLA School of Law, and Julie Ortiz, Water Conservation Manager with San Francisco Public Utilities Commission. Thanks to all of you for joining me this evening. For a link to this and other City Visions shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page on kalw.org. Our engineer this evening was Kevin Vance, and tonight's show was produced by Susie Britton. Join regular host Joseph Pache next Monday as we discuss the addictive qualities of technology. This is guest host Zara Zimbardo. Thank you for listening. Good night and have a great week.